Welcome everyone to the Sunday Roast. Unfortunately, we don't have Max with us, but we do have a brilliant co-host and an excellent guest. Phil, could you please introduce yourself to anyone who may not know who you are?
Hi, so I'm Phil Morehouse. I am a former teacher who discusses political commentary on YouTube now on the channel A Different Bias.
And Madge, excellent. Thank you very much for coming onto the show. And Madge, my co-host for today.
So I'm Big Madge Studios. I'm standing in for Max as co-host, and I run kind of a new channel covering British affairs, current affairs predominantly. And they're keeping me busy because this is just endless.
And thank you, Madge, for being co-host today. And I'm Alex, also known as Political X, YouTuber, journalist, historian. Today we're going to be talking about just about anything and everything. 14 years of Tory failure, Phil. What are your initial thoughts on a sentence like that?
I mean, it's quite tragic. It's hit me personally as well. I mean, a very close friend of mine was one of the people that I suppose would have been one of the austerity statistics. He died, in my view, as a direct result of a change that David Cameron brought into the way GPs do things. And but, you know, in that 14 years, I mean, when at the start of that 14 years, I was a teacher. I'd been a teacher for a bit over 10 years. I started my teaching when Labour first came to power, and I saw investment come in to teaching. It wasn't always spent in the best way. I've said this before, interactive whiteboards were a hideous white elephant, but you couldn't fault the money. The investment was there. The pay in the first 4 years, I've forgotten what percentage it was now. I think it was something like starting teacher salary went up about 26% or something. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it went up a lot. And then at the end of it, by 2010, you know, we're in a good place, and you've got everything, you've got your equipment, you're getting training, you feel education's been properly funded, teaching assistants, and, you know, EMA. So in colleges, attendance is really good because students are financially incentivized to be there, so you don't really have attendance issues. All of a sudden, it changes overnight. Within a few years, that's all gone. Training, it's like, okay, oh, there's this really... It used to be the case, have you booked your training? You know, what training have you booked, Phil? You were expected to go on training. You were expected to find some training. All of a sudden, if you weren't, and if you found some, it's like, okay, is it free? No, you can't go there. We'll pay your travel, but you can only afford the free. So all you went, yeah, I mean, it just overnight stopped. The pay stopped. I mean, I used to joke, after about 2015, I was the only teacher in the college getting a pay rise because of YouTube. I did a different channel then. So that was the only way for a teacher to get to actually keep up with inflation. And the same will have been happening, of course, in all public services. And we are now at the point where the Conservatives cannot name anything that they have improved. You know, they'll talk about, say, recently, oh, we've hired a load of extra police officers. Yes, but it's still fewer than we had, and it's certainly fewer per capita. And you've done that by dragging in a load who initially failed the recruitment selection process, and some of them have got addiction problems and even criminal convictions, which is not usually a great thing for a police officer to have. There's nothing that's better. Everything is worse. But everything over this parliament has been made noticeably worse, and they will complain, oh, but that's because of COVID and the war in Ukraine. Yes, they just put on the extra pressures which exposed the fact that they'd left us in a weakened position, because we've never recovered from the global crash. We had the economic crash, which Rishi Sunak was personally involved in. Yep. Labour have made a little bit of that. I would have liked to have seen them make more of that. I don't think enough people know. And yet, you know, we were recovering, and we should have recovered, and we never did, because the first thing the Tories did when they came in is, first of all, they put taxes up, they put VAT up, and then said, oh, we need to shrink the state, austerity. And it's just gone downhill from there, to the point that when we had then, most particularly COVID, we were not equipped to deal with it economically or in terms of basic infrastructure.
Well, there was no plan. They literally had no plan. I bring it up quite often. They would meet for the Queen's death 3 times a year, and they met once in 7 years for the public safety in COVID.
Global pandemic, was the number one threat to the nation, according to the Conservative government. David Cameron made speeches about it internationally, trying to warn the world, we need to do something. It was considered, as far as this government was concerned, the number one threat to the nation, the number one national security issue, a global pandemic. Granted, they were expecting a flu rather than a SARS-based one. And we should have had everything in our favour. We're an island. We had two infectious disease experts as the chief medical officer and the chief scientific officer. We had a pandemic response unit, which wasn't brilliantly kept. And then Boris Johnson decided to elbow it literally a few months before the pandemic hit. We still don't have one now. No one's thought, oh, that was a bad idea. Should we start it back up again? That's not happened.
Did you, like, one of the last times you were on here, we were talking about the Canary Islands collapsing into the sea.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember which one. We all I mean, the British scientists are the ones that are leading the investigation into this. And I say scientists, geologists. And I do wonder if that little alert system is the entire plan. That they remember, Madge, the alert system they pulled out that Lawrence Fox tried to poo-poo is like a silly idea. I think that is the only thing that you're going to get. You're going to get a text message. It's not if, it's when that piece of rock collapses into the sea. You'll get a text and you'll have about, I think it's 30 minutes to get out of Cornwall, and that's it. And there's no infrastructure to help you get out because there are major roads and railway lines to get you out of there. I'm going to throw it over to Madge. What are your thoughts on all this, Madge?
I'm glad it's ending, to be honest with you. I think with the school stuff there, you know, I was a student when New Labour were there, and as kind of the coalition took hold, and because I've got younger siblings, I did notice the class sizes did get bigger, you know, 30 plus. When I was doing GCSEs, kind of year 10, 11, I want to say the class sizes were under 30 and the teachers were managing a lot better. You know, it would take them time to come over to you and obviously help. And I was a student who did need a lot of help. But, you know, I think as kind of the class sizes got bigger, they got a lot less help, a lot less support. And teachers had to do a lot more in terms of, I think, the admin side of it. There were a lot more expectations on targets. You know, kind of the artsy stuff like music was underfunded because they wanted to push these kind of certain kind of courses, you know, like it was called, is that history, English, maths? History or geography, English, maths, a language.
They tried to call it a baccalaureate.
That's it. Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah, so they tried to push that. And obviously, if you're a creative, you know, which is something the conservatives, you know, don't like, you kind of hampered, especially if you're a working class kid who wants to get into music and things like that, or into painting or anything like that. They really hampered that side of it with the NHS, like, you know, endless winter crises every year. I remember during the mid-2010s when Jeremy Hunt was there, he was beefing with junior doctors. He was, you know, people were dying in corridors and things like that. 2024, they blame the pandemic. 2016, why was it happening back then? They blamed the backlog on the courts on COVID when that was happening before 2018. That's something the secret barrister talks about. And so all of these kind of systemic problems that became worse due to COVID, they were all there beforehand. And so I'm kind of glad that, you know, this kind of style, let's say, the sticking plaster politics, you know, those kind of people are gone, where the only moment they react is when we're in a crisis. And they're like, their first reaction is, oh my God, guys, we're in a crisis. Who could have predicted this? Like with the pandemic planning, the only prime minister, I think, to add to the stockpile was Gordon Brown. Boris Johnson didn't do it. Nope. Theresa May didn't do it. David Cameron didn't do it. Nope. And so when they went back to their stockpiles, they're like, oh, these are from pre-2010. And you're just like, yeah, moron. That was when we had someone who actually knew what they were doing, had seen a pandemic in, I think it was the SARS outbreak in Far East Asia. And he was like, yeah, we should be prepared for this stuff. And David Cameron was like, look, guys, we're not going to have enough teachers for the schools or doctors for your healthcare needs. Forget the stockpile. We don't need that. Planning's for idiots.
And do you know, every 100 years, leave it down the road, gone, Phil.
That SARS thing that I was just talking about there. So I remember I worked at a different college at the time. And as you say, that was mostly contained within Asia. It didn't really hit us here.
Yep.
And yet we still took it seriously. There were people having the temperatures checked at airports. We had the safety inspector at our college going around giving us training on stuff in case there was an outbreak in the college.
And when was this?
This is in, like, it must have been
early 2000s.
Early 2000s. I left that college about 2004, 2005 or something. And so they were taking it seriously, even though it didn't really, it was precautionary. And yet when it actually hit us, we weren't, like, there were people coming in through the airports. No one was checking them. You know, nothing was being done. Mm-hmm. There was no precautions when it was actually hitting us. And the absolute madness of a prime minister that goes, I've got a brilliant idea. Let's just let this thing rip through the population.
Herd immunity. which they denied.
They were doing interviews with people abroad, like some of the scientists, and they're saying what you're doing is so dumb. Herd immunity will rip through the country. It will kill lots of people. Yeah. And the dude who was being interviewed, I don't know which country he was from. I think it's from a European country. He's like, you guys are crazy. It's like the bit in Jurassic Park, the mother said, let the dinosaurs out and eat people. You know, the fittest will survive. It is the equivalent of that. And you're like, when I saw that interview, I'm like, this guy's taking it very seriously. Why aren't the rest of us? And that's when you had one of the professors, he was like, oh, you know, we're going to do herd immunity. And then in the end, he came out and did an interview, I think a year or two after the first wave, and said, oh, I couldn't believe we could just tell people to stay inside. I thought people wouldn't do that. And I'm like, who the fuck told you that? Like, who gave you that information? Like, it was wild. Like, you know, were you told, like, oh, we can't, you know, protect people because people won't listen, and therefore we have to go to herd immunity? Because that's what it felt like. The scientists were effectively told that wouldn't work. That's not politically feasible. Come up with something else. And they were pushed to a certain position of herd immunity.
There's a couple of things to that. They did bring in consultants. That's who, I can't remember the group who they brought in, but I know they brought in consultants who were saying that the population wouldn't obey. And I just think to myself, well, they did with World War II when we had the blackout. I know it's not quite the same, but there is an element of being locked in your house at night and all the lights are switched off and every curtain is shut off. From being able to allow light to get out, there is something within population.
The Blitz spirit.
Will, yeah. Once you explain it sensibly, instead of the dittering crap that came out of Boris, people will actually listen to you.
The problem was they didn't want to do it because their attitude, you know, these libertarians, they're not really about low state control. They're about low state control of the privileged elite. This is why before we had the lockdown, what did Boris Johnson try? He just told people, can you not go out, please? Because he and his mates wanted to go out, and they were thinking in their heads, if all the masses, if the plebs stayed at home, then we can go out with our top hats and tails and it'll actually be fine because we'll minimize the risk, which, okay, if that's how it works, that's not how it works. So then it was like, oh, you little rascals, you didn't stay in, so I'm going to have to put lockdown on now. Everything was about letting them carry on as if everyone else had to make a sacrifice, but not them, because they hate it when they have to comply with restrictions.
Preach it, Phil.
I think one of the other things is there was that big horse race event that was happening, and Matt Hancock, I think, was given advice at the time to not go through with it, and he had taken donations. And so he felt like he was in a position where he didn't want to do it. And that's one of the other things where I think one of the lines Starmer, which was quite good, you know, saying they cashed in during COVID. I'm surprised he hasn't pushed that more, because I think that's a really effective line to push. I think that's a really effective line, especially if you mention stuff like that, where they took donations directly from certain companies to not take action in the first place. And then when you look at, you are right, you know, the belief that, you know, people just stay home, it'll be fine. And you can see that with Partygate. They're like, oh, well, it's not my fault. You didn't understand the rules, you idiot. Yeah. And it's like, the rules were very clear, like gathering, that wasn't a necessary gathering to say bye to people. You do that over Zoom. You just say, oh yeah, sorry, you're leaving. Good luck. Bye.
So I mean, two things to that. There is a text message. There was a tweet that went out from a question that was sent to one of the departments, one of Boris's departments, which said, are we allowed to have work parties? And there is a direct no from that tweet saying, no, you are not allowed to have work parties. So that's unequivocal, but it never gets brought up. But then the other thing, because it's Cheltenham, wasn't it? That was the...
Yeah, yes. I think it was, yeah.
Yeah. So there was another one which is even worse as an example. It was Atletico Madrid versus Liverpool FC.
Yes.
And Atletico had stopped people going into the stadium. So you couldn't go and watch the Champions League game in Madrid, but you could go and watch it in Liverpool. And it just said everything. I mean, Boris was caught. There's a claim that Boris was just laughing at the Italians for dying.
Yes,
in
he
such
did.
Large numbers.
I remember that.
Yeah.
He was taking the piss out of them.
This is the guy who said, I shook hands with COVID patients. And you're like, what are you doing, guy? Like, if you want to make this look like a joke, that's not saying, yeah, I got bit by a zombie in Raccoon City. And see, I'm still fine as he's twitching because he's turned to a fucking zombie. Like, this was honestly the biggest clown at any circus was the guy in charge of our country. And that's one of the reasons why we struggled so much. And that's kind of indicative of the Conservative Party. They're very reactive. They're not proactive with anything. And they're happy to shrink the state. If we were in a better position, we could have dealt with COVID a lot better. And there'd still be people alive to this day.
Do you think I'll follow up with that, because we're talking about neoliberal and obviously the incompetence of Boris. We've got the incompetence that he did it was interesting. I did a video recently for the last 14 years of Tory bad behavior. You sort of look at Cameron and then May, and there's like three or four little controversies in each one. Shouldn't say little. There are three or four controversies in each one. And then you get to Boris and it's just like it's gone onto steroids. And there must be about 50 controversies just with his premiership. But we're going to go on to the IEA and Liz Truss. Do you think it's because we're talking about liberals and neoliberals, and I often compare them to a bunch of hippies. They just seem to think that everything will sort itself out, and if it doesn't, you die, and who cares? It's all part of life. Do you think neoliberalism and trickle-down economics is dead? I'm going to throw that to Madge first.
I don't think it's necessarily dead. I think it has taken a backstep. If you look at the core of it, it's the idea that human beings are logical, and therefore we don't need so many rules. And I'm like, I don't know, guy, have you read a history book? And so I don't think it's necessarily that dead. I think it's still there. I think it's, people still believe in it. But it's taken a big backstep because the way Liz Truss did it was the implementation, I think, that really killed it, because she was desperate. Because if you look at what David Cameron, he did a similar thing where he cut the top rate of tax in the mid-2010s. And he said, well, that money will trickle down and rich people spend more and blah, blah, blah. And no one really said anything at the time because there wasn't a massive like economic crisis kind of preceding that, because he did welfare cuts. Liz Truss couldn't do that as much because there wasn't a lot of welfare to cut. And so what I'd say is I don't think it's necessarily dead as an ideology, like the idea of tax cuts and trickle down. It's the way the markets reacted. And I think if you get another conservative prime minister or kind of a right-wing prime minister who doesn't cause the same kind of market quake, I think they can push it. They can still push that kind of idea of trickle-down economics. It's just the way Liz Truss did it in the most brain-dead way, which is, oh yeah, the tax cuts will generate growth. And then everyone's like, can we see a source for that? And she was like, no.
Can't reveal the IEA.
Yeah, it's like, can the OBR put a report on that? And they're like, who? The IEA already covered it. They said it's fine. So that's what I'd say.
The IEA, of course, being the ones who about 10 years earlier were publishing reports saying that we shouldn't have qualified doctors, that the market, which we're now not getting, because you're getting these, like, what do they call, pharmacy assistants, I can't remember what they're called, something like that. And but that's what they said. They said we should just let doctors be doctors, people be doctors, and the good ones will get, it's like this thinking, the good ones will cure their patients, and that word of mouth, they'll get more business, and the bad ones will kill their patients and no one wants to go to them. That's literally what they're saying. So we don't need qualifications for doctors, we don't need training, you know, the good ones will, that is what they were writing in the early 2010s, and now we've moved to a position where they're moving towards that, where there are some jobs where I can say where sometimes you have someone with particular qualifications and there's some aspects of their job they probably shouldn't be doing. Like, we're used to the idea of, for example, you don't have a dentist clean your teeth, you have the hygienist do that. When I worked at a school, like a school where they went away from the old sort of head of year system, because you were basically paying a teacher to deal with ties. So what they did is they got, you know, sort of people that would be like teaching assistant grade people on much lower salaries to deal with that sort of messing about, rather than a teacher dealing with, have you got your tie on, or little administrative tasks that you don't need to be a qualified teacher for. So you can sometimes have those sorts of efficiencies. But what you can't have is a system where you go, yeah, we don't really need this high level of training and qualifications and all that business, you know. And that's why at the moment there is a plan to get doctors to qualify in like a short amount of time. That's one way of keeping them in the NHS, because no one else will hire them. But it's all about, it's like Madge was saying, it's all about this quick fix. It's because they think to themselves, if they have to spend anything, that's money they can't use for a tax cut, why spend it if you don't absolutely need it right now? So there's no like building something up for the future.
It's very short-termism. If you look at, you know, there were medical places going in Britain, and the people running those schools were saying, look, if the government funds it, we can hire, you know, people in Britain effectively, and they can study here and they'll probably stay here long-term. And then the government didn't take it and other countries filled up those spots and they'll probably go back. And that's not a slight on them to say, oh, how dare they? But it's the school wants to make money from teaching medical students. The government don't want to put the money up for these medical students. Other countries, you know, their governments or however can fund it. It just makes sense. And so that's the thing that is very short-termist. You know, the fact that people would rather pay more in tax if it meant public services improved. And, you know, the Conservatives are like, nah, what are you, stupid? No, you want money in your pocket. Who cares if you can't see a GP? Your tax cut, you know, a little bit of that can go to a private doctor. It's ridiculous.
There's an element of The Simpsons. I think there's an episode where they can't try and fund the school through taxes. And so they're like having a town meeting and they're saying, oh, we want kids to have a good education. You know, Marge and Homer and the rest of the community are going, yes, we want good education. And then Skinner comes in and he's like, taxes, more taxes. And everyone's like, no, no, no taxes. And in the end, the solution is to convert all the cupboards at the back of the classroom into prison cells.
The other thing on this is like,
I could really genuinely, I think of pitching that to some conservatives and they go with that idea. And the example I give, which is absolutely fascinating, because there was another report from the IEA about privatizing the police force. And I was like, that's how the mafia in Sicily got going. That's one theory, is that there was no police force. So they privatized it and it turned into the mafia. And you've got the IEA saying they want a private security force.
With the school thing, they could put white-collar criminals in the school, so all the kids become scam artists and stuff. But with the doctor thing, I think one of the things with the Conservatives, like, doctor takes around 7 years to train up. And I remember, I think it was in 2015, Jeremy Hunt said, oh, we've trained a record number of GPs. And I think it was Ed Miliband who said, yeah, you're welcome for that, because it takes about 7 years to train a GP. And that's the thing where Jeremy Hunt was trying to take credit for something, obviously, Labour had done. And so that's one of the reasons why they don't want to do stuff like that, because it's all short-term fixes. All the things they push, it's less than 5 years. So they can see, you know, straight electoral benefit, and they can push. I think, Phil, you talk about a lot of the green shoots thing, where they talk about, oh, you know, the economy's recovering. Oh, look, we're the fastest growing economy in the G7. We've turned a corner. And you're like,
note the caveat, quarter? this quarter. They say that bit very, very quietly. Fastest growing economy.
And of course, if you let Labour in, we'll be the slowest growing economy in the G20 the next quarter. That's what they'll say. And that's what I mean. Like, they do push very short term things. And, you know, the media let them get away with it. I mean, like I said, that debate was abysmal. And he got away with the 2K tax light again. And I'm just like, God, this is embarrassing. I was like, who could be worse than Laura Koonsberg? And I think her name is Misha. I was like, yeah, I can do that. The moderation was just so bad.
Brexit hasn't been talked about as well. And it's interesting because I've been running the numbers, and along with a number of other people, and our calculations are coming back. It's going to cost us to get back to 2016 economic levels about $1 trillion and take 14 years. That's from all the damage of Brexit, and that's not including the issue of 600,000, 500,000 a year leaving. Mm. That is not taking into account the 1.56 birth rate, which means that you need about 400,000 a year coming in to make up for that deficit, which interestingly is almost the same immigration numbers as what the Conservatives have at the moment, 1.2 million. Any thoughts on the fact that Brexit hasn't been brought up in the election and as to why? And I mean, I think the answer is going to be obvious, but with that level of economic damage, I'm looking at what they're suggesting and you're going, in 2 years' time, the public I could see being outraged. I'm going to throw it to Phil.
So I don't think the problem is, from the Conservatives' point of view, they like to say they delivered Brexit, but they blame the people, will of the people. But they know they haven't got anything to convince the people with, so it's not really in their interest. From Labour's point of view, it's like they can't do anything because ultimately we don't qualify really to do anything without it being politically settled. The EU can't be arsed with us if the Conservatives are just going to, which they will say, when we win the next election, we're just going to cancel the whole thing anyway. So you're sort of trapped. And then you do have this thing. And I'm going to confess, back in after the last general election, I didn't appreciate this. I knew it was happening. I didn't really appreciate the scale of it myself. There are a lot of people who got really hurt over it. And I've seen, for example, my fiance's family, they can't really talk about politics. They used to, and they can't anymore because Brexit split them. And there are some families where they didn't have the wisdom to realize they can't talk about politics. And so those families are now like, all friendships have like been damaged. And I say, because it's not something that shows up on a poll too easily, I didn't appreciate that a few years ago. It's something that cannot be ignored. Now, you know, for my money, we need more conversations going. I support people like Steve Bray and Mike Galsworthy and people like that who want to hammer the politicians on it. There's part of me thinking, I know that Labour can't really talk about it because it's like, then they look impotent because they can't do anything at the moment. Well, they can. There's lots of things they can do, but everyone thinks in terms of like the three big things, which they can't just yet. But the other part of me thinks, but at the same time, we have to have that conversation. And the media are not creating that conversation like they should. So how do you do it? The only way you can do it is to hammer politicians, as unfair as it might be. At the end of the day, people choose to be politicians, as it says, and right. Forget the odd unfair question. So that's why I do support people And I don't mind if some people treat it as if it should be a simple thing to say, well, at least that should be the direction of travel, even though I know that they can't say that. Because how else are you going to get people talking about it?
It's difficult, isn't it? And the media not helping. I'll bring up some statistics in a minute. Manj, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I kind of saw it yesterday, why they're not doing it in that debate, because I know it's going to come out on Sunday. As soon as they mentioned trade relationships, Sunak talked about the Windsor framework. I think he mentioned something else as well. And he said the only way to get a better trade deal is with freedom of movement, which obviously we know is not true.
Michel Barnier said that. Well, is that what you're referring to? And just clarify.
No, it was the debates.
Sunak did say that.
Yeah. And so he kind of kept hammering that point. And so I think because freedom of movement is so toxic, and that's something we've been on here, spoke about before, there is kind of, securing borders, all of this kind of notion that still exists within England. And so what that means is that freedom of movement is obviously so associated with the EU so much that it's so difficult for them to have that conversation because they are trying to build a coalition of of certain types of voters. If you look at what Starmer said recently about Bengali, it's so weird what he said. It didn't make much sense, honestly, because he singled out the Bengali community, and I think a lot of people felt like that. My mum mentioned it to me today, and she's like, "Did you see what he said?" And she the thing that annoyed me was, and if mum watches this, I'm dead. But what she said, what she claims Starmer said, is not what he said, but it's kind of gotten out there as kind of misinfo. And that's what I mean with migration. It's so toxic, and with freedom of movement being as toxic as it is in England, that's one of the key reasons why they're not going to talk about the EU. Because that lady's question, she said her business has dropped off by about 90% because of Brexit selling vinyls. And so in the end, it went to immigration because the host did a shit job of keeping it onto the conversation of trade. How an alignment deal, I think Labour are pushing equivalency or alignment. I don't know how that's going to help with vinyl trade. Because obviously that's to do with vet stuff, isn't it? So
you could, that might help a tiny bit. It doesn't stop
If there's less checks and things like that, I think that will help with less customs. If they can get something on that,
The big thing that they are going to do, and no one's really talking about it, has been talked about in the Financial Times, but when I went to the Labour conference last year, Stella Creasy was all over it in a fringe event, is the Pan-European Mediterranean Convention. So what that does is it includes obviously every EU country, but also a load of non-EU European North African countries. And it effectively allows goods produced there to class, for rules of origin purposes, tariff free. So it creates a larger pool of countries that you can import resources from and use in your manufacture and production without incurring tariffs. Now, you'll still have the paperwork, because if you want to claim something to be tariff free, you have to have the paperwork to prove that it's come from some of these countries. But that is something that sort of helps. It's almost like a little toe into customs union territory, in that it makes it easier to have tariff free trade. And that's what there's a lot of these, and what some trade experts are saying, there are a lot of, because we think about customs union single market because we used to be in both of them and we should have stayed in both of them, and then we wouldn't have had this problem. Would have just been chuntering that we didn't make the rules. It's like, well, who chose to leave? But there are a lot of agreements with other countries that replicate small parts of them. And the idea is that Labour want to be getting involved as many of those as possible. Some should be relatively straightforward. Some will require negotiation and therefore not be straightforward at all.
Yeah.
Can tie it in with, as I've suggested, and I think they've tried to suggest as well, security issues where we have a stronger hand. But obviously the EU don't want to go with that. So we will see.
I did slightly think there was a slight backdoor move to, because you could use the excuse of Ukraine and what's going on over there and Putin being just a general ass, that you could use that as a beginnings of reconciliation and rebuilding trust without sort of triggering the mainstream media, newspapers. And
it has to be kept boring. Absolutely, to be kept as dull as ditch water.
I think with the security stuff, the UK being the laundromat for a lot of Russian money, and of course, the fact that the UK's military is in a complete mess where there's a guy's channel, War of Graphics, where he covers this stuff really well. And he was just saying in a fight with a near pure adversary, the UK would not last a few months because we don't have the supplies and things like that. So I think a security agreement is out of the question, especially when we got hacked by China recently, literally this year. I think they would want a security agreement, but I don't think they're going to be like, trade for security. I don't know about that. But as I said before, with the trade thing, like with the vinyls, that specific person, one of the key problems is if you're the person buying the vinyls, you have to fill out paperwork. And so if you can find another supplier within the EU or within the EEA area where you have to deal with less paperwork and less potential costs, you're going to go to that seller. And I think that's one of the key problems as well with trade, where even if you reduce the amount of paperwork, it's good. But unless your goods are unique or, you know, very limited, they're going to look for alternative options to buy from, and they'll go to wherever's easiest. So one of the key reasons why Britain's trade has dropped off so much is because there are lots of alternatives for things like shellfish. You know, the stuff that we exported and was purified in France. I think Croatia have taken a lot from that kind of area of British fishing. And so that, because the EU is such a big, big area, they have so many different countries they can import things from in terms of trade. And, you know, it's not a massive loss in some ways.
It works both ways as well. There was a poor fella who had to shut up his shop. He had a high street shop selling like novel lamps, like lots of different lamps. And from his point of view, he wasn't exporting them. He wasn't.
Hail the lamp.
He may have had a life of lamp.
You're going to hail that lamp.
He probably did. But, no, if he had more lamps.
He wasn't exporting them. His problem was that the suppliers in the EU wouldn't supply him, because, of course, he didn't need large volumes. He needed like a couple of types of lamp from a place in Germany, and it's too much hassle with the paperwork. So they just said, it's too much hassle, we can't supply you. So his shop had to shut down because he could not get stock. Because he's not someone who buys a lorry load of the same product. It's like a couple of lamps from this shop in Germany, a couple of lamps from this shop in Belgium, this shop in Netherlands, and they're all just saying, the order's too small, it's not worth our time.
Michael Lambert lost his entire business overnight.
He's moved to France, hasn't he?
Michael Lambert?
Oh, sorry, now I'm thinking
there
of
was
Lambert
another dude. I know who you're thinking of. There was another dude, he moved to France. Daniel, he just said, Lambert. I've had enough. He said, I've had enough. The Cheshire Come Cheese on. Guy, I think he sold up.
Truth to power.
I'm just going to bring in, because otherwise I'm going to not get these points across and we're going to move too far away. Rob Truth to Power also lost his entire business overnight. He was like supplying British actors into the EU. Gone. Couldn't do it. So that's just an example. And sorry, Phil, did you want to make an example of someone else who lost a business?
I was just going to say about the Cheshire Cheese Company. So the guy there, because... you know, it was like more for a health certificate than the consignments of cheese he was sending. He needed to be able to send large amounts of cheese to somewhere in the EU and stuff from there. So he ended up effectively selling his business to someone else, but still sort of works there, works for it. But he's basically had to sell a big stake of his business because that person had that like warehouse or whatever in the Netherlands, I think. Because that's what you have to do.
I think it was in France. Yeah, I think it was in France.
But you had to be able to move. You can move reasonably efficiently a large quantity and then distribute the smaller stuff from the EU, but you need that office and warehouse in the EU.
If you're moving large quantities of similar goods, I think you don't need health certificates. And what you do is you store it over there. But if you're buying a British cheddar, for example, and you're buying, say, 2 kg of it, that needs a health certificate. That's going to need a lot of export paperwork. And those health certificates cost a fortune. They are more than the cheese is worth. Yeah. And in the end, like I said, the importers just kind of gave up on it. And I think he realized that he needs to change business model. And there's a lot of companies that are doing that, where they just move stuff in bulk and they'll just try and store it as best they can, which obviously has additional costs.
So they charge per pallet, not on anything else. So unless that pallet is full of your own goods, or you can somehow split that pallet, you're going to pay regardless of the size for the entire pallet. And then it comes onto that paperwork. If I'm a business, do you want to do business with several hundred million people in the EU or 62 million? Which one do you want the more hassle with? Do you want the hassle of exporting into 200 and the paperwork of that, or vice versa? And as a business person, I would always go, well, it makes more sense to go into the EU, more customers, less hassle. And if I want to, I can go into the UK market, but it'll be harder. And it's because of that paperwork. Freedom of movement, I find really interesting. The UK's got freedom of movement with 4 countries plus overseas territories. So you can move between those countries without...
Maybe not Gibraltar.
Not anymore. That's such a mess.
That Gibraltar situation is...
And they got away with it. Another scandal. Sorry, Brad. Sorry, Matt.
With Gibraltar, they did, that situation there is... We basically said, look, whatever you're going to do, just deal with it on your own. Just keep it away from the press, effectively. And they have managed to figure it out on their own. But freedom of movement. I remember I covered a Channel 4 segment where there was a guy, ironically, in the Costa del Sol in Spain, saying, I thought they would have kept it for the proper Europeans. I'm like, who are they? Who can you please explain to me which countries are proper Europeans? And that's the mentality. When Brexit kicked in and a lot of them had to sell up in Spain, I think they realized, like, yeah, you know, everyone's treated relatively equally, like in terms of freedom of movement as well. You know, Schengen is the only like question mark, the only difference really. But if you're a German citizen coming here or a Romanian citizen coming here, you're treated roughly the same by the system. And so,
Not by
yeah, it
Nigel.
was. Oh yeah, not by Nigel.
Not
Yeah,
by Nigel.
You don't want to live near Nigel.
Unless you're Russian.
He'll
If
give
you're
you
Russian,
abuse
you can live near Nigel.
if you're rich, an oligarch. But you wouldn't want to live in Clacton, so it's fine. But point being is that it's not. Like I said, with freedom of movement, I think that's the most difficult issue when it comes to Brexit. And as we saw in that debate, that's the thing that Sunak really went for. And he's, you know, he went for the, you know, you said you'd defend freedom of movement as we left the EU, you know, going back to the leadership pledge. And so it is still a toxic issue because they don't want to have, neither of the major parties want to have a sensible a conversation on immigration apart from the SNP, because Scotland does need more migration.
Yeah.
You know, Starmer talking about reducing net immigration and things like that.
But he
When, as you said
can't.
earlier,
He
yeah.
can't. He will cause an economic crash if you go below a
It
million.
depends where you count it from. If you count it from that peak, it would naturally come down anyway.
What, from 1.2 down to a million?
From, you know, yeah, from where it peaked last year, it would just naturally come down. So it's like it's taking your baseline, isn't it?
What, the 600,000 leaving
Yeah,
or the.
the net migration in. That was artificially boosted effectively as a result of a few things last year. So it would naturally have come down anyway. So they could just be taking it from there.
But then you still have the issue. So Max and I have talked about this on previous programs where he referred to Ireland, I've referred to people leaving Italy, and we've referred to Japan because Japan's birth rate is pretty much knackered. And you're going, Shinzo Abe, Abe economics didn't fix it. Italy's still suffering from it, and they're having to bribe people from abroad to come and move into their towns. And we're in that similar situation. I think we're about maybe 10, maybe 5 years behind where Japan was when it was having the economic crisis because they weren't having enough kids. And I'm going, and people leaving Ireland, that was the 80s. I mean, we're dwarfing that. We've got literally the size of Glasgow leaving every year. I don't see how economically you can fix that. You've got to convince people that the economy's good.
You
And if they're
do,
continually leaving,
but potentially the plan, I mean, I don't know, I can't read their minds, but potentially the plan is if you look at what some people think are the negative consequences, if you can reduce those. So what are people's problems? Access to public services, access to housing, for example, the visible signs, like the, you know, they inflate the hell out of asylum, even though we take hardly any bugger. The visible signs of that are the use of the hotels and the boats crossing. If you can remove a lot of those pressures, most people, I mean, there are people who can be persuaded to like cut off their own nose for purely ideological purposes, but most people just want their own lives to be all right.
Yeah, I'd agree
And
with
I
that
suppose
overall.
that it would be the plan to try and do that.
But I'm going to be mean. I'm going to be mean about the Labour policy because I was looking at the manifesto and I
Please.
did check with a friend of mine and we were both like, isn't their housing policy tied in with another section of their policy? And it's basically two or three sentences when the housing crisis is pretty much the most important thing that needs to be dealt with. And I've been banging on about the solution with three or part of a solution with 3D printing, which there is zero mention of in any manifesto.
So yeah, there is. But what I would also say is housing is actually throughout everything. They include housing as a key part of improving healthcare. They use housing as a key part of improving the economy as well. So actually housing, although it's relatively straightforward, 1.5 million extra houses, or homes, the
Over how many years? Is it 4 or 5 they're planning to
five.
stay? It'll be 5. So crisis says you need 400 or 400,000 a year,
Well, does
which would not
it?
be enough. That would be
Because
two
I thought I
million.
saw something recently that was saying, because at the moment we're not knocking down many houses. But I don't know. And it also could be, remember, and they've been really clear about this, the manifesto is not, we're going to do this. The manifesto is, this is the minimum we're going to do. So who knows? I mean, it's one of those things you just have to see. But I mean, that's another thing. I mean, you know, one of the ways in which the Tories have been extremely stupid at the moment, because they're banging on about taxes all the time, and people are basically going, we don't mind the taxes, we want the public services. They've now got the public ready to believe that Labour are going to put up taxes. So then it's like, so what disincentive is there for Labour to put? And I know they've ruled out putting up certain taxes, like the key ones for most people. And they've said, you know, no taxes upon working people. And they've defined that as people on low to middle incomes. So what, you know, for example, the big talk about capital gains tax. Good. You know, if Labour in their first budget say, right, I don't know whether they'll bring it straight in line or in bits by bits. I'm not an economist, but if they say, right, you know, this is ridiculous, capital gains tax, we're going to start to bring it in line with income tax, no one's going to complain. And the Tories will have set them up for it because Labour will be saying, we're going to spend it on this, which is what you want.
Yeah, which is what you want.
With the capital gains, though, I think Rachel Reeves has ruled that out, hasn't she, raising capital gains tax?
Not at all.
No.
Nope.
Don't think so.
Made a point of not ruling it out.
And it's the same. They've not mentioned dividends. No one brings that up. And I don't understand why the first... Is it 15 or 30K from dividends is at 9% tax?
Yeah.
And considering it's a profit, I would have gone bang that to 20. Who can complain if it's a profit?
Yeah.
So I never understood that.
Some people can. I don't know. It depends on... It's one of those things you have to look at your target voters, isn't it? I don't know. I mean, like, you have things with inheritance tax. Labour's only policy on inheritance tax is to cut off people's offshore trusts to get out of paying it, which is good. In fact, Dan Needle has said you could actually raise the threshold of inheritance tax and get more inheritance tax by stopping buggers further up the chain getting out of it altogether. But the problem with inheritance tax, the political thing there is 4% of people pay it, but polling last year showed that about a third of people think they'll pay it, and that's sometimes where you have your problem. Whereas for capital gains tax, I don't see that that works. Capital gains tax isn't a tax you might pay in the future. You either pay it or you don't. And 97% of people know they don't pay it.
I mean, like, according to the Labour list, they've put out a quote saying that she said, Rachel Reeves saying, quote, no, I haven't changed my mind because I've already said we have no plans to increase.
Yeah.
They put CGT, capital gains tax, end
That's
quote.
What they said.
Yeah.
That's not ruling it out. What they've said is, they've been very careful about it. They said, we don't need to put up capital gains tax to fund our manifesto. But they've also said they want to do more than the manifesto.
I mean, that's an assumption, though. That is an assumption. They've said explicitly they're not going to raise capital gains tax.
No, they haven't.
There's no plan.
No plan.
You know, there is that quote there. There is no plan.
That's
right?
Fine.
Not planning on doing it.
The first budget's in a year's time. I mean, they could, in theory, do an emergency budget next month, or they could. I mean, there's going to be a mini budget. They can easily. And I know people are going to call it bullshit, and it will be bullshit. But there's nothing to stop them coming in and going, right, we've sat down with the Treasury officials. There's a lot of schools collapsed. There's a lot of hospitals collapsed. There's a lot of reports they were sitting on that they weren't showing us. The situation is much worse than we thought. Every economist in the country will yell bullshit. We know how bad things are. But Rachel Reeves can come straight out and go, they were hiding all this. There's this report. It's all terrible. And, you know, we need to deal with it.
I think with that, you know, it's clear that the schools are crumbling and things like that. And I think if Labour did say they're going to raise capital gains tax in line with income tax, I don't think many people would have a problem with it. And it's just a bit weird that they're not laying the groundwork. And I think if, you know, I think as you've said before, like, Labour need to get growth. And I think if they come in straight away, they raise the tax, they get more money into the exchequer, can use that money far more quickly, and you can get you can actually start building things more quickly, rather than if you come in, say, you know, in 2 years' time, and you say, all right, guys, you know, we've done as much as we can here, but we're going to increase capital gains tax, and then you're waiting for a bit longer for that money to come in and to allocate it. It makes way more sense to get this stuff done as early as possible, get the income in, and then you can start coming up with plans. Because, you see, we've talked about the fiscal rule ad nauseum, and so what they need to do is either grow the economy or, you know, get more money into the exchequer. This one's a slam dunk. There's no one who's, I think there's not many people, unless you benefit from capital gains tax, you know, the loophole we kind of have is going to say this is a bad idea, because a lot of people are on PAYE and they'll say, why am I paying more in tax than someone who makes money off stocks and shares? So I think that's why this one is quite mind-boggling and a bit frustrating, because this one's an easy one.
But I think it's also going to be one they do. I mean, I'll tell you, you know how you might get the impression, I certainly got the impression, that it's almost like, you know, they're sort of calming everything down. It's like, you know, we're the phrase Wes Streeting kept using is we're gonna under promise and over deliver, and it's all calming down, managing expectations. And yet, in two interviews in the last week, in the Financial Times, Keir Starmer, you know, the journalist was put to him, oh, are things still going to be a bit crap in 5 years' time? He says, no, not at all. So they're not. And Rachel Reeves has said something similar for a different interview. They're not working on the basis, because this would be a massive gamble, they're not working on the basis of basically looking like a competent government, hoping the Tories are still shit in 5 years, win another election to give themselves the 10, even though they talk about the decade of renewal. They know, and the Keir Starmer and Rachel have both said so in the last week, they know that people have to see tangible improvements this Parliament. or the next.
Yeah, I think the question is, you know, Labour have said they want to have the fastest growing economy, sustained growth in the G7, yeah, right? And so the question is, how are you going to achieve that, given that you've spoken about borrowing in that way, given the fact that they're talking about private investment, and there was apparently a Labour, this is from Alex Wickham in Bloomberg, talking about BlackRock's in a rebuild Britain. It was a joke, but there's a lot of private money coming in, and is drawing the comparison of PFI 2.0, which PFI was not good for the country, objectively. And so that's one of my fears of, if you're not going to increase borrowing and you're saying you're going to get the highest growth, especially with America being in the G7 and you've got Biden's plans, well, you know, he's got, you know, great, you know, plans for America if he's reelected, which hopefully he is. How are you going to achieve? And that's the key question I think everyone, or at least I've been asking, and I think other people have, is if you're still saying you're going to get the highest sustained growth in the G7, how are you going to achieve that goal? How are you going to achieve growth? And that's the thing then I think I've struggled to find answers on.
You can't anyway, just simple law of percentages. You can't ever have the sustained highest growth of anyone, because if you did for a few years, you outstrip at some point. I mean, all that happens when your growth tails off, you can still be growing really quite well, but it's just your economy's, or you know, it's maybe grown really well for a few years. Now it grows not quite so well as a percentage term, and then another country does. You know, these things go in fits and starts.
So it's that's what makes it nonsense. A weird pledge. That's what makes it a dumb thing. That's what I mean.
And well, it may not be dumb, but it is very weird.
If you say, you know, if we talk about smart targets, you know, specific, measurable, attainable, you know, this one in 5 years' time, they're going to go back through this. Did you achieve the high sustained G7? And, you know, if he comes up with the answer of, well, technically, that's impossible because of how percentages work, I'm going to be like, what is this, my guy, math class? You know, like, you know, this at GCSE maths no more.
Could you argue that as long as people feel that their life, they don't actually give a shit about details like that?
That's the key there. And that's what I mean. Like, I think they were better off talking more about that. You know, Starmer does say in some of the speeches, you know, in 14 years, do you feel better? And I think that's one of the things he should have run with more. I think, you know, whilst they were cashing in on COVID and wasting taxpayers' money, we would have invested that money into the economy. I mean, the fact that they don't mention the 38, I think it's about 38 billion on Test and Trace, that's a travesty. That's a slam dunk. They could have said we would invest that money into Britain. And we could improve public services. There's so much more. You know, the fact that you could buy Manchester United football team with that money and still build an all-star team and still have money left over is nuts. You know, and you look at it was given to consultants and all sorts of other nonsense, which had no effect.
To be fair, Keir Starmer couldn't say that, otherwise the Sun would be saying to him, oh, you want to use our money to buy immigrants, do you?
Do you think they'd go that far?
I see what he's saying.
When Matt was talking about that Bangladesh thing, which, someone cut up. I mean, I think the mistake there was actually doing a thing with the Sun, because, like, you didn't need to.
No, he didn't.
He's done enough. He'd done enough debates. He'd already done, like, three.
I'm going to further that a little bit with, I bring this up quite a bit, with FDR. He had very similar problems. He had the worst depression in American global history. And he just went for it. And I think Starmer's, I mean, the Gamblegate thing is just, that's the end of the Tories. That's them done. Because he can't, because stories keep leaking out each week, it's a slow drip of death. He could suddenly bring out a number of those policies and go, you know what, I'm going to bring that out, and I'm going to do this now, and I'm going to change the manifesto, and you can still vote for me, and it's a guaranteed slam dunk win. And I look at FDR and who he took on, which was Hoover. Hoover was a neoliberal, and he was a bit of a Donald Trump. He'd never been in politics. So there's an element of, like, similarity here, which I feel Starmer is just not capitalizing on. He's still playing it safe. And I get there's an issue with the mainstream media, but I think Gamblegate's just the final nail in the coffin there. He could say literally anything. He could come on stage and do anything to a politician, and he's still going to win.
I think, you know, he could again talk about how the Tories are enriching themselves even during an election. Do you know, the cash for COVID, cash during COVID, cash for elections. It writes itself. But I was going to just quickly on Starmer, just to end that point there. I think one of his problems is he goes too far in one direction, where, you know, when he mentioned the situation in Gaza, where that was clipped up very easily. And it took him 2 weeks to kind of clarify on that. With this situation currently, he has come out much quicker and said, you know, the Bengali community is integral for the Labour Party and for Britain. And I think it's much better he come out quickly. But as I said, like, it's, you know, once that statement goes out, it's done, because the WhatsApp chats have been apparently pinging. And organically, I wanted to do it as a little test. You know, I wasn't going to bring it up to any of my family members just to see if they brought it up. And they did. And I was like,
they did.
It's cut through. It's cut through. And I don't know, you know, it's a small population, but it is, you know, it could be key in certain swing seats. I don't know. And that's what I mean. Like, he says things that are just really dumb and off the cuff remarks where he doesn't prepare. He's not prepared for these sorts of questions. Like the fact that they asked him, which country are you going to get returns agreement with? And he's like, oh, you know, we'll see. And he's like, well, which country? He's like, oh, Bangladesh. And I'm just like, my guy, like, how are you not prepared for these questions? It doesn't make sense.
But it's also,
I mean, he's not a politician. You do get a bit of that.
Yeah.
At least there are politicians around him there. There are politicians on the front bench.
He's got quite an experienced front bench, hasn't he?
They're veterans.
People actually been in government, which is pretty interesting.
The further problem is the front bench, you know, go out and parrot those lines. You had Jonathan Ashworth the other day pushing that line about, deportations and asylum seekers from Bangladesh. And I'm like, you've just doubled down on this now. There's going to be a second clip that goes out. And whatever the retraction is, it does not get the push that the initial statement gets. Because the people who want to push that stuff, the people with good intentions, they might push it. They might be pissed off and say, you're done. And the ones with bad intentions are going to be like, I ain't going to push that. It's an apology. I don't care. You're not my guy.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. It's, you know, in politics, it's like the open mic thing as well. You've just got to... You've got to really be aware of everything you say and think it through in advance. But as I say, I thought the biggest error was actually doing that something in the first place, because I didn't see it needed to be done. Know how Harry Cole was going to try and do. We know how it was going to be. I mean, at least he wasn't stupid enough to go on GB News. But, you know, that was like just...
I think there is an art form to going on like those kind of channels. Like when Bernie Sanders went on Fox in that town hall, and he did really well on that. There is, if you're a confident politician and you're confident in your policies and your own ability as an orator and to answer questions on the fly, you should do it. If you're not confident, if you've got big kind of introvert vibes, don't go into enemy territory where they're going to be plants in the audience and they're going to ask you questions, because you're going to make yourself look silly. Like, you know, Boris Johnson hid in the fridge. But at least they didn't have, like, do you know what I mean? There's a reason why he did that, because he knew he goes on interviews, he's going to get torched. And so
he was ahead.
Yeah.
He was massively ahead in 2019. Starmer was massively ahead in 2024. He only had to just not look like he was running away. Yep. No one was going to accuse him for running away by going, The Sun, that's a newspaper. I'm not sitting on a newspaper, you know, for a debate. It doesn't do television. That's all he had to say. He said, look, I'm doing whatever it was, BBC, ITV,
Channel 4.
Channel 4, was it? I can't remember. But yeah, I mean, that was enough. And then there was the various other debates with, like, you know, the multiple parties as well. He'd done enough. He didn't need to do that. It was an unnecessary risk to say that the strategy has been this carrying the Ming vase across the highly polished floor. That was an unnecessary risk. And
in the vase, I think. And that's what annoyed me, because you already annoyed large parts of, you know, the Asian community and stuff like that, and the Muslim community, and you're like, you just kind of, it doesn't make sense. And you know, these, like I said, these are core Labour voters, some of these people, and you know, you might lose their support for a long time. Now we saw the Iraq war have a similar effect, and so you've got to be careful when you come out of statements and you ask follow-up questions. Like, you're going on The Sun, they're going to ask you about immigration, they're going to ask you about Rwanda, they're going to say, what's your plan? And if you haven't prepared enough, you're going to look stupid. And I think that's one of his big problems, where he's not confident in himself and he does stumble a little bit. I think the Gaza interview was, if I was in, I'd be like, look, yeah, we're going to give you serious media training here, because you can't keep fumbling like this in interviews, because you're going to lose votes. And those votes are, they're either going to stay at home, which is not great, or they'll vote for the Green Party or the Lib Dems potentially. I think a lot of those voters have gone to the Green Party. He needs to seriously buck up that kind of stuff, because you lose votes. It's an unforced error, they'll call it in tennis. And I think that's what we saw, two really big unforced errors from Starmer. It doesn't give you confidence in him, in my opinion. At least I don't feel confident in him when I see stuff like that. Because it's like, you're doing an interview with, you know, kind of, it's going to go on YouTube or something like that, The Sun's YouTube channel. Like, why are you so, like, nervous and scared? Yeah, on edge.
I'm gonna bring in the social media side of things as well. How have you felt their social media campaign's been going? Because obviously Sky did a very interesting report 2 or 3 days ago suggesting that Reform had 1.5 million in terms of social media interactions, whereas Labour, who'd spent about 3 or 4 times the amount of Reform, had only half of that, I think 500,000. Conservatives are about the same in social media interactions. Do you pay much attention to any of that, or do you think there's something else?
I mean,
we know
Reform UK, the interactions there aren't human. But in terms of the social media, like, you know, you look at some of the, I mean, Labour put out a really good social, like a Twitter ad today, and some, they've done a few good ones. They've done a couple of mad ones. The Tories have just lost their minds. That Angela Rayner as a sort of French Mario was really just weird. The Shining one.
What? I need to find this. What?
Oh, Rainer it's absolutely brilliant. It's on
that's
Twitter.
Beautiful.
That so is, they've got Angela Rayner talking about something popular. I've forgotten what it was now. What was it? But they then start to put like a weird beret and a big like moustache on her, like making out that she's French. Like she's this socialist. Oh, is this socialism? Socialism. It's like, yeah, that's what people are voting for now, mate. and then they did the Shining one, where they did this Twitter thing, and it was like, what do Labour bring you? Tax, tax, tax. And I literally, you have to scroll down for like a minute. And it's like,
oh, wow.
They're paying someone to do this. But just in terms of, I mean, their social, I keep saying, like, as a YouTuber, I understand, like, they're mad. You know, YouTube is watched on the, I went to a YouTube event quite recently. In America, YouTube is watched on the television more than Netflix. I know from my last week's analytics, 19% of all my views are on the television. So people are watching YouTube like a lot, and they're not, Labour aren't using it. Labour put out that really good, there was a really good ad. It was someone actually on James O'Brien's show describing the Conservatives like a crap plumber or something, or like a carpenter. And it was really good. And they put it on their YouTube channel and it got like a few hundred views in like an hour. And I'd put my short, which was just a random short I threw out, and it got like twice as many in the same amount of time. And I don't really do shorts. I just do like one a day just to get to a few more. So that roundabout times like now, I've got an audience, because about 14% of my viewers only watch shorts, which means that come a campaign time, I can put out the things like, this is the deadline for registering. This is this, you know, this is the thing, this is the date for this, tactical voting sites, blah, 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 message, message, message. And they don't understand that on social media, it has to be mostly engagement. You need to bring an audience in, you want to engage them, and then you weave your messages into that, but it's all message. It's, we want to get this message out, that message out. That's not engagement. Your message isn't engagement.
No, it's not.
And they don't get it.
The other interesting thing that came out of that was when looking at rejoining EU statistics, they're above Lib Dems for engagement, but they're not in the actual sheet that Sky brought out. Depends on how you run it. I think you have to look at either, you have to, I'm not sure if you include YouTube or TikTok engagement as well within that social media, whether or not it's actually included social media, but it should be included social media. And you're going, right, so that's being pushed to one side. And it makes you wonder, did they do that on purpose, or did the person running the actual statistics just not realize that there was a party called Rejoining EU?
Lots of things pushed to one side. I mean, even The Guardian, it's like they've hardly done any reports on the Lib Dems. Lib Dems could lead the opposition, hardly anything. You expect it in the Tory media. And you're looking at The Guardian, you think, well, they're quite friendly towards the Lib Dems, is my perception.
Mm.
And there's nothing.
And yet,
it's why they're doing mad stunts. That's why he's doing like water slides and Boris jumping in rivers and stuff. Like, you know, people mocked him for that. And I think there is a bit of, I think it does deserve a little bit of mockery, but he's got to do it to get media attention. And, you know, the water slide one, I think maybe he just wanted to go on a water slide, to be honest with you. But the one in the river, that one, you know, that's brave because we know what's in those rivers and it's not good. And he still went in there. And that raises the point of, well, you know, these rivers are full of pollution. That's why there's barely anyone here and we're going to clean up. And so I think that one's a good one. You know, some of them they've got to be a bit careful on. But, you know, I think this is the only way he's going to get media attention. And I think he realized by doing weird stunts, because that's what the media love, a circus. And he's kind of, he's figured out, he knows he's boring, so he has to make himself a little bit entertaining. With the social media engagement stuff, the only one time where Labour were successful, I think, in that is when they posted that weird post of Rishi Sunak talking about he's on the side of rapists or something like that. That was really bad. And it got a ton of engagement because everyone's like, this is a really bad poster. You know, why the fuck have you posted this?
Oh, the attack ads, yeah 2 years ago, yeah.
And then when I saw it, it was, I'm not going to mention his name just in case, but one of the Labour shadow cabinet members was very happy about it because it got a lot of engagement and they were like, this is what we need. And it's like, engagement is one thing, but if people are clowning you, that's not a good thing. Like, the Tories will get engagement because they get community noted, and everyone in the replies is like, "How you got community noted, you dumb prat." And that's what a lot of the Tory messages are. So the engagement is important, but it's got to be like a more positive kind of engagement rather than people clowning on you in the replies. And Labour have tried to post more memes and stuff, and it just feels like more "how do you do, fellow kids" type vibes. It's very difficult to make it kind of feel organic. That makes sense.
Do you think the Russians and the Chinese are backing Farage and that social media campaign?
I certainly don't think he's getting natural engagement on social media.
Have you guys witnessed, since the election was started, comments on your channels that are vote, like saying vote reform?
And yes, I have.
And it's just shot through the roof.
I have seen a lot more of that. Like, I'll be voting Reform because of this, but I don't know.
But they're not engaging with the video and what the video
Yeah.
says. They're just saying the word because it's a bot. How much, if you were to chuck it in as a percentage, what would you say your engagement from that type, those types of bots are?
I'm not sure, but I have seen it more in the comments because I do check them. Like, so I don't get a ton of comments on most of my videos, but I have noticed this is why they'll post something and say, this is why I'm voting Reform, or only Reform can fix this stuff. And it feels like the bots maybe have gotten a bit better than last time. But on Twitter, it's easier to tell which one's a bot because you can kind of tell by their account. You know, it'll be what's the joke? Is my name's something, lots of numbers, and I've got the worst take imaginable. And it's gotten more prevalent now. I can't remember the meme. I'll try and find out, I'll try and send it to you, but it's really good. And so that's how the bots go. But I have noticed it a lot more. And it's hard to tell because you don't know if those people are getting more kind of politically engaged and going on YouTube. And it could be just crazy Reform people saying, oh, this is a pro Labour video or an anti-Tory video, and saying, oh, yeah, you know, I'm just going to write vote Reform on here, not bother engaging with it at all because I want more people to see that Reform have support, because they are desperately looking to look like a party that has, you know, decent support.
Well, Richard Tice has done two videos so far where he says, look at all these people around my car. And he's at a boot sale and there's no one there. And then he's at a pub and there's no one next to it bar one old lady.
He's not a draw.
Well,
There's a
are
reason why he wanted
you a
Farage.
moron?
Yeah,
There's a reason why he wanted Farage. He's not a
they've
draw.
only got yeah, they've only got Farage,
No,
and
no one
even
cares about
Farage
Tice.
hasn't exactly pulled in loads. He's like he's their only star. He's pulled in some numbers that they could use camera angles to make it look like loads.
What, Lee Anderson isn't a star?
No,
What? Where is he? I've not heard anything
he's having
from
to
him.
campaign his own constituency because, you know, I mean, it's very difficult with some of these seats, like, to really know where it is, because they are really weird individual. I mean, Ashfield's messed up anyway. Ashfield is a messed up place, so I don't know what's going on there. I just sort of hope for the best. But you know, but in a lot of these places, it's quite. I mean, they're just going to go with the angle, oh, we've got like the third highest share of the vote and like two seats. What's going on? Type moaning. It'd be interesting to see if they decide electoral reform's the way to go, or they just want to play the victim for a few years.
I think they will, because I think that's something Nigel Farage has talked about. He said the only time I got electoral success was proportional representation, ironically, thanks to the EU systems that they use for MEPs. But he has talked, Nigel Farage has talked about that before, about electoral reform, and I think he'd be a big supporter of it, because UKIP, I don't know what their max vote share was. I think it might have been like in the double digits, and they
Oh,
won
it
no
was about
MPs.
15% or
15,
something.
I think so.
Something like
Yeah,
that. It
okay.
was, or close to it.
It was, yeah. And they won no seats, and he was mad. He was mad about that. Because of the fact that, you know, he's won, you know, he sh like as a, as annoying as UKIP are, they should have had a seat under, you know, a PR system, or a couple of seats. But that's what I mean. Like, it is a very bad system that we have in place.
But it does keep Nigel out, which is the plus.
It
No,
keeps
I
fringe
don't.
parties out. But they took the Tory party. Like, he won
That's
in the end.
exactly it.
Yeah.
All you have to do is you all you have to do is take over one of the broad church party, because the concept of a broad church party is you have these factions within it, and a faction becomes the leader, and then you've basically and that's what happened. So it doesn't keep them
And
out,
then
in
it
my view,
collapsed the
at all.
Conservative Party,
Yeah,
which is
it
also
collapsed
a
on itself.
plus, because they just come up with these populist policies, and whenever a populist turns up and starts splitting these policies forward, they never work unless they become a dictator and then force it through and fudge all the statistics.
Let's not give
But
them
like,
ideas.
populism doesn't work. It's such a stupid
Well,
idea
thankfully,
because it's a
Nigel
fraud.
Farage is genuinely unpopular. Like, he's got this cult following, which is sizable, but it's not. If you look at polling, it's not like, because sometimes you look at people's approval ratings, you go, oh, this is good or this is bad. But there's usually, for most politicians, a massive amount of don't knows. But Nigel Farage doesn't have that many don't knows. A lot of people do have a firm opinion on him. And it's like, you know, 15 to 18% like love him, and like two-thirds of people think he's a
When you look at how long he's been around for, like, he's been around longer than most of the politicians, most of the MPs that are there, you know, most of the front name, like, you know, Starmer and Sunak, I think, came in the 2015 intake, and, you know, Nigel Farage has been pushing this stuff way before then. I think he was pushing I don't know when the UKIP, like, when he joined UKIP, but he's been pushing the Brexit stuff for decades now, and so people will have a firmer opinion of him because he's a much more he's been around for a lot longer, and people are more familiar with his game, and so they've made their opinions up of him when they saw him in 2016 or 2019 potentially.
What I do know is we're quite popular here. If you like what you heard today, please click that like and subscribe button. If you like these guys, check them out. Their links in the description. Thank you so much to our guests. Max, we miss you. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Be sure to tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
Dealing with 62 million. If I'm a business and I've got to make a decision, do I go UK or EU? Do I want the hassle of dealing with 262 million? No, it's 400 million, isn't it, in the EU?
People? It's not many people. Many people.
It is several hundred million.
Oh, God, have we actually got three political broadcasters that don't
Well, I forget what it is when you remove the UK.
It's a lot of people.